The wind was cold. Pig snow was falling and Milo Pulcher had holes in his shoes. He trudged through the pink-grey slush across the square from the courthouse to the jail. The turnkey was drinking coffee out of a vinyl container. Expectingly, he grumbled, Which one do you want to see first? Pulcher sat down, grateful for the warmth. Doesn't matter. Say, what kind of kids are they? The turnkey shrugged. I mean, do they give any trouble? How could they give me trouble? If they don't clean their cells, they don't eat. What else they do makes no difference to me. Pulcher took the letter from Judge Pegram out of his pocket and examined the list of his new clients. Avery Fultus, Walter Hopgood, Jimmy Lasser, Sam Schlesterman, Bork Smith, Madeline Galtrey. None of the names meant anything to him. I'll take Fultus, he guessed, and followed the turnkey to a cell. The Fultus boy was homely, pimply, and belligerent. Cripes, he growled shrilly, are you the best they can do for me? Pulcher took his time answering. The boy was not very lovable, but, he reminded himself, there was a $50 retainer from the county for each one of these defendants, and the conditions being what they were, Pulcher could easily go to love $300. Don't give me a hard time, he said amiably. I may not be the best lawyer in the galaxy, but I'm the one you've got. Cripes. All right, tell me what happened, will you? All I know is that you're accused of conspiracy to commit a felony, specifically an act of kidnapping a child. Yeah, that's it, the boy agreed. Do you want to know what happened? He bounced to his feet and began acting out his story. We were starving to death, you see. Arms clutched pathetically around his belly. The icicle works closed down. Cripes, I walked the street for nearly a year looking for something to do. Anything. Marching in place. I even rented out for a while, but that didn't work out. He scowled and fingered his pimply face. Pulcher nodded. Even a body renter had to have some qualifications. The most important one was a good-looking, disease-free, strong and agile physique. So, we got together and decided, the hell, there was money to be made hooking old Swinburne's son. So, I guess we talked too much. They caught us. He gripped his wrists like manacles. Pulcher asked a few more questions and then interviewed two of the other boys. He learned nothing he hadn't already known. The six youngsters had planned a reasonably competent kidnapping and talked about it where they could be heard, and if there was any hope of getting them off, it did not make itself visible to their court-appointed attorney. Pulcher left the jail abruptly and went up the street to see Charlie Dickon. The committee man was watching a three-way wrestling match in a flickery old TV set. "How'd it go, Milo?" he greeted the lawyer, keeping his eyes on the wrestling. Pulcher said, "I'm not going to get them off, Charlie." "Oh, too bad." Dickon looked away from the set for the first time. "Why not?" They admitted the whole thing. Handwriting made the Hopgood boy on the ransom notes. They all had fingerprints and cell types all over the place. And besides, they talked too much. Dickon said with a quick spark of interest, "Well, what about Tim Lasser's son?" "Sorry." The committee man looked thoughtful. "I can't help it," Charlie, the lawyer, protested. The kids hadn't even been routinely careful. When they planned to kidnap the son of the mayor, they had talked it over, quite loudly, in a juke joint. The waitress habitually taped everything that went on in her booths. Pulcher suspected a thriving blackmail business, but that didn't change the fact that there was enough on tape to show premeditation. They had picked the mayor's son up at school. He had come with them, perfectly willingly. The girl, Madeline Galtrey, had been babysitter for him. The boy was only 3 years old, but he couldn't miss an easy identification like that. And there was more. The ransom note had been sent special delivery, and young Fultus had asked the post office clerk to put the postage on instead of using the automatic meter. The clerk remembered the pimply face very well indeed. The committee man said politely while Pulcher explained, though it was obvious that most of attention was on the snowy TV screen. "Well, Milo, that's the way it goes. Anyway, you got a fast 300, hey? And that reminds me..." Pulcher's guard went up. "Here," said the committee man, rummaging through his desk. He brought out a couple of pale green tickets. You ought to get out and meet some people. The party's having its annual Chester A. Arthur Day dinner. Bring your girl." "I don't have a girl." "Oh, you'll find one. $15 per," explained the committee man, handing over the tickets. Pulcher sighed and paid. Well, that was what kept the wheels oiled. And Dickon had suggested his name to Judge Pegram. $30 out of 300 still left him a better week's pay than he had had since the icicle works folded. The committee man carefully folded the bills into his pocket, Pulcher watching gloomily. Dickon was looking prosperous, all right. There was easily a couple of thousand in that wad. Pulcher supposed that Dickon had been caught along with everybody else on the planet when the icicle works folded. Nearly everyone owned stock in it. Everyone owned stock in it, and certainly Charlie Dickon, whose politician brain had got him a piece of nearly every other major enterprise in Altair 9, a big clump of stock in the tourist agency, a sizable share of the mining syndicate. Certainly he would have had at least a few thousand in the icicle works. But it hadn't hurt him much. He said, "None of my business. But why don't you take that girl? Madeline Goltry? She's in jail. Get her out, here." He tossed over a bondsman's card. Pulcher pocketed it with a scowl. That would cost another $40 anyway, he estimated. The bondsman would naturally be one of Dickon's club members. Pulcher noticed that Dickon was looking strangely puzzled. "What's the matter?" "Like I say, none of my business, but I don't get it. You and the girl have a fight?" "Fight? I don't even know her." "She said you did." "Me? I don't know any Madeline Goltry. Wait a minute, is that her married name? Didn't she used to be at the Icicle Works?" Dickon nodded. Didn't you see her?" "I didn't get to the woman's wing. Pulcher stood up, oddly flustered. "So I'd better run along, Charlie. This bondsman, he's open now. Well..." He stopped babbling and left. "Madeline Goltry. Only her name had been Madeline Cossett. It was funny that she should turn up now in jail." And Pulcher abruptly realised, likely to stay there indefinitely. But he put that thought out of his mind. First he wanted to see her. The snow was turning lavender now. Pink snow, green snow, lavender snow, any colour of the pastel rainbow. It was nothing unusual. That was what made Altair 9 worth colonising in the first place. Now, of course, it was only a way of getting your feet wet. Pulcher waited impatiently at the turnkey's office while he shambled over the woman's wing and slowly returned with the girl. They looked at each other. She didn't speak. Pulcher opened his mouth, closed it, and silently took her by the elbow. He steered her out of the jail and hailed a cab. That was an extravagance, but he didn't care. Madeline shrank into a corner of the cab, looking at him out of her blue eyes that were large and shadowed. She wasn't hostile. She wasn't afraid. She was only remote. "Hungry?" She nodded. Pulcher gave the cab driver the name of a restaurant. Another extravagance. But he didn't mind the prospect of cutting down on a few lunches and over a few weeks. He'd had enough practice at it. A year before, this girl had been the prettiest secretary in the pool at the Icicle Works. He dated her half a dozen times. There was a company rule against this, but the first time it was kind of a schoolboy's prank, you know, breaking the headmaster's regulations. And then the other times, it was a driving need. Then came the Gumpert process. That was the killer, the Gumpert process, whoever Gumpert was. All anybody at the Icicle Works knew that it was somebody called Gumpert. Back on Earth, one rumour said. Another said he was a colonist in the Sirian system. Someone called Gumpert had come up with a cheap, practical method of synthesising the rainbow antibiotic moulds that floated free in Altair 9's air, colouring its precipitation and, more important, providing a priceless export commodity. A whole galaxy had depended on those rainbow moulds, shipped in frozen suspensions to every planet by Ultramycin Inc., the proper name for what everyone at Altair 9 called the Icicle Works. When the Gumpert process came along, suddenly the demand vanished. Worse, the jobs vanished. Pulcher had been on the corporation's legal staff, with an office of his own, and a faint hint of a vice presidency, some day. He was out. The stenos in the pool, all but two or three of the 500 who had once got the correspondence and bills, they were out. The shipping clerks in the warehouse were out. The pump hands at the settling tanks were out. The freezer attendants were out. Everybody was out. The plant closed down. There were more than 50 tons of frozen antibiotics in storage, and though there might have been a faint trickle of orders from old-fashioned diehards around the galaxy, backwards country doctors who didn't believe in the new-fangled synthetics, experimenters who wanted to run comparative tests, the shipments already en route would much more than satisfy them. 50 tons? Once the Icicle Works had shipped 300 tons a day. physical transport, electronic rockets that took years to cover the distance between stars. The boom was over. And of course, on a one-industry planet, everything else was over too. Poulter took the girl by the arm and swept her into the restaurant. "Eat," he ordered. "I know what jail food's like." He sat down, firmly determined to say nothing until she had finished. But he couldn't. Long before she was ready for coffee, he burst out, "Why, Madeline? Why would you get into something like this?" She looked at him, but did not answer. "What about your husband?" He didn't want to ask it, but he had to. That had been the biggest blow of all the unpleasant blows that had struck him after the icicle works closed. Just as he was getting a law practice going, not on any big scale, though Charlie Dickon and the party, a small steady handout of political favours that would make it possible for him to pretend he was still an attorney, the gossip reached him that Madeline Cossett had married. The girl pushed her plate away. "He emigrated." Poulter digested that slowly. Emigrated? That was a dream of every niner since the works closed down, of course. But it was only a dream. Physical transport between the stars was ungodly expensive. More, it was ungodly slow. 10 years would get you to Del, the thin-air planet of a chilly red dwarf. The nearest good planet was 30 years away. What it all added up to was that emigrating was almost like dying. If one member of a married couple emigrated, it meant the end of the marriage. We got a divorce, said Madeline, nodding. There wasn't enough money for both of us to go, and John was unhappier here than I was. She took out a cigarette and let him light it. You don't want to ask me about John, do you? But you want to know. All right. John was an artist. He was in the advertising department at the works, but that was just temporary. He was going to do something big. Then the bottom out dropped out just for him, just as it did for all of us. Well, Milo, I didn't hear from you. Poulter protested. It wouldn't have been fair for me to see you when I didn't have a job or anything. She said, of course you'd think that. It's wrong. But I couldn't find you to tell you that it was wrong. And then John was very persistent. He was tall, curly-haired, he had a baby's face. Do you know he only shaved twice a week? Well, I married him. It lasted 3 months, then he just had to get away. She leaned forward earnestly. Don't think he was just a bum, Milo. He really was quite a good artist. But we didn't have enough money for paints, even. And then it seems that the colours were all wrong here. John explained it. In order to paint landscapes that sell, you have to be on a planet with Earth-type colours. They're all the vogue. And here there's too much ultramarine in the clouds. Poulter said stiffly, I see. But he didn't really. There was at least one unexplained part. If there hadn't been enough money for paint, then where had the money come from for a starship ticket, physical transport? That meant at least $10,000. There was just no way to raise $10,000 in Altair 9, not without taking a rather extreme leap. The girl wasn't looking at him. Her eyes were fixed on a table across the restaurant, a table with a loud, drunken party. It was only lunchtime, but they had a 3 o'clock air, three o'clock in the morning air about them. They were stinking. There were four of them, two men and two women, and their physical bodies were those of young, healthy, quite good-looking, perfectly normal niners. The appearance of the physical bodies was entirely irrelevant, though, because they were tourists. Around the neck of each of them was a bright golden choker with a glowing red signal jewel in the middle. It was the mark of the tourist agency, the sign that the bodies were rented. Milo Poulter looked away quickly. His eyes stopped on the white face of the girl, and abruptly he knew how she'd raised the money to send John to another star. Poulter found the girl a room and left her there. It was not what he wanted. What he wanted was to spend the evening with her, and to go on spending time with her until time came to an end. But there was the matter of her trial. 24 hours ago, he had got the letter notifying them that the court had appointed him attorney for 6 suspected kidnappers, and looked on it as a fast fee, no work to speak of, no hope for success. He would lose the case, certainly. Well, what of it? But now he wanted to win. It meant some fast, hard work if he was to have even the chance, and at best, he admitted to himself, the chance would not be good. Still, he wasn't going to give up without a try. The snow stopped as he located the home of Jimmy Lasser's parents. It was a sporting goods shop, not far from the main tourist agency, It had a window full of guns and boots and scuba gear. He walked in, tinkling a bell as he opened the door. "Mr. Lasser?" A plump little man, leaning back in the chair by the door, got slowly up, looking him over. "In back," he said shortly. He led Pulcher behind the store to a three-room apartment. The living room was comfortable enough, but for some reason it seemed unbalanced. One side was somehow heavier than the other. He noticed the nap of the rug, still flattened out where something heavy had been, something rectangular and large, about the size of a Tri-V electronic entertainment unit. "Repossessed," said Lasser shortly. "Sit down. Dickon called you a minute ago."
"Oh?"
It had to be something important. Dickon wouldn't have tracked him down for any trivial matter. "Don't know what he wanted, but he said you weren't to leave till he called back. Sit down. May'll bring you a cup of tea." Pulcher chatted with them for a minute while the woman fussed over a teapot and a plate of soft cookies. He was trying to get the feel of the home. He could understand Madeline Gaultrey's desperation. He could understand the Foltis boy, a misfit in society anywhere. But what about Jimmy Lasser? The elder Lassers were both pushing 60. They were first-generation Niners off an Earth colonizing ship. They hadn't been born on Earth, of course. The trip took nearly 100 years, physical transport. They had been born in transit, had married on the ship. As the ship had reached maximum population level shortly after they were born, they were allowed to have no children until they landed. At that time, they were all of 40. May Lasser said suddenly, "Please help her, boy, Mr. Pulcher. It isn't Jimmy's fault. He got in with a bad crowd. You know how it is. No work, nothing for a boy to do." "I'll do my best." But it was funny, Pulcher thought, how it was always the crowd that was bad. It was never Jimmy, never Avery, never Sam, never Walter. Pulcher sorted out the 5 boys and remembered Jimmy. 19 years old, quite colourless, polite, not very interested. What had struck the lawyer about him was only surprise that this rabbity boy should have had the enterprise to get into a criminal conspiracy in the first place. "He's a good boy," said May Lasser pathetically. "That trouble with the parked cars 2 years ago wasn't his fault. He got a fine job right after that, you know. Ask his probation officer." Then the icicle works closed. She poured more tea, slopping it over the side of the cup. Oh, sorry. But when he went into the employment office, Mr. Pulcher, do you know what they said to him?"
"I know."
They asked him, would he take a job if offered," she hurried on, unheeding. "A job. As if I didn't know what they meant by a job. They meant renting." She plumped the teapot down on the table and began to weep. "Mr. Pulcher, I wouldn't let him rent it if I died for it. Isn't there anything in the Bible that says you can let someone else use your body and not be responsible for what it does? You know what tourists do. If thy right hand offend thee, cut it off. It doesn't say, unless someone else is using it, Mr. Pulcher. Renting is a sin."
"May."
Mr. Lasser put his teacup down and looked directly at Pulcher. "What about it, Pulcher? Can you get Jimmy off?" The attorney reflected. He hadn't known about Jimmy Pulcher's probation before, and that was a bad sign. If the county prosecutor was holding out an information of that sort, it meant he wasn't willing to cooperate. Probably he would be trying for a conviction with maximum sentence. Of course, he didn't have to tell a defense attorney anything about the previous criminal records of his clients. But in a juvenile case, where all parties were usually willing to go easy on the defendants, it was customary. "I don't know, Mr. Lasser. I'll do the best I can."
"Damn right you will, Bart Lasser. Dick can tell you who I am. I was committee man here before him, you know, so get busy. Pull strings. Dickon will back you, or I'll know why."
Pulcher managed to control himself. "I'll do the best I can. I already told you that. If you want strings pulled, you better talk to Dickon yourself. I only know law. I don't know anything about politics." The atmosphere was becoming unpleasant. Pulcher was glad to hear the ringing of the phone in the store outside. May Lasser answered it and said, "For you, Mr. Pulcher, Charlie Dickon." Pulcher gratefully picked up the phone. Dickon's rich, political voice said sorrowfully, "Milo, listen. I've been talking to Judge Pegram's secretary. He isn't going to let the kids off with a slap on the wrist. There's a lot of heat from the mayor's office." Pulcher protested desperately. But the Swinburne kid wasn't hurt. He got better care with Madeline than he was getting at home.
"I know, Milo," the committee man said. "But that's the way she lies. So I wanted to say to you, Milo, is, don't knock yourself out on this one because you aren't going to win it. But Pulch was suddenly aware of the Lassers but just behind him. But I think I can get an acquittal, he said, entirely out of hope, knowing it wasn't true. Dickon chuckled. You got Lasser breathing down your neck? Sure, Milo. But you want my advice? You'll take a quick hearing, let them get sentenced, and then try for executive clemency in a couple of months. I'll help you get it. And that's another another 500 or so for him, you see? For you, see? The committee man was being persuasive. It was a habit of his. Don't worry about Lasser. I guess he's been telling you what a power he is in politics here. Forget it. And I say, tell him I notice he hasn't got his tickets for the Chester A. Arthur Day dinner yet. You pick up on the dough from him, will you? I'll mail him the tickets. No, hold on, don't ask him, just tell him what I said. The connection went dead. Pulcher stood holding a dead phone, conscious of Lasser standing right behind him. So long, Charlie, he said, paused, nodded into space, and said, so long again. Then the attorney turned about to deliver the committee man's message about the most important subject. The tickets to the Chester A. Arthur Day dinner. Lasser grumbled, damn Dickon, he's into you for one thing or another. Where do you think I'm going to get $30? Tim, please, his wife clutched his arm. Lasser hesitated, oh, all right, but you better get Jimmy off here. Pulcher got away at last and hurried out into the cold, slushy street. At the corner, he caught a glimpse of something palely glowing overhead and stopped, transfixed. A huge sky trout was swimming purposefully down the avenue. It was a monster, 12 feet long at least and more than 2 feet thick at the middle. It would easily go 18-19 ounces, the sort of lunker that Swartzman hiked clear across the dismal hills to bag. Pulcher had never in his life seen one that size. In fact, he'd only remember seeing one or two fingerlings swim over inhabited areas. It gave him a cold, worried feeling. The skyfish were about the only tourist attraction Altair 9 had left to offer. From all over the galaxy, sportsmen came to shoot them, with their great porous flesh filled with bubbles of hydrogen, real biological zeppelins that did not fly in the air but swam in it. Before human colonists arrived, they had been Altair 9's highest form of life. They were so easy to destroy with gunfire that they had almost been exterminated in the inhabited sections. Only in the high, cold hills a few survived. And now? Were the fish even aware that Altair 9 was becoming a ghost planet? The next morning, Pulcher phoned Madeline, but didn't have breakfast with her, though he very much wanted to. He put in the whole day working on the case. In the morning, he visited the families and friends of the accused boys. In the afternoon, he followed a few hunches. From the families he learned nothing. The stories were all about the same. The youngest boy was Faltus, only 17. The oldest was Hopgood at 26. They'd all lost their jobs, most of them at the Icicle Works, saw no future, and wanted off-planet. Well, physical transport meant a minimum of $10,000, and not one of them had a chance in the world of getting that much money in any legitimate way. Mayor Swinburne was a rich man, and his 3-year-old son was the apple of his eye. It must have been an irresistible temptation to try to collect ransom money, Pulcher realized. The mayor could certainly afford it, and once the money was collected and they were aboard a starship, it would be impossible for the law to pursue them. Pulcher managed to piece together the way the thing had started. The boys all lived in the same neighborhood, the neighborhood where Madeline and Joan Galtry had a little apartment. They had seen Madeline walking with the mayor's son. She had had a part-time job now and then taking care of him. The only part of the thing that was hard to believe was that Madeline had been willing to take part in the scheme once the boys approached her. But Milo, remembering the expression on the girl's face as she looked at the tourists, decided that wasn't so strange after all, for Madeline had rented. Physical transport was expensive and eternally slow. But there was a faster way for a man to travel from planet to planet, practically instantaneous, from one end of the galaxy to another. The pattern of the mind is electronic in nature. It can be taped, and it can be broadcast as an electronic frequency. What was more, like any electromagnetic signal, it could be used to modulate an ultra-wave carrier. The result? Instantaneous transmission of personality anywhere in the civilized galaxy. The only problem was there had to be a receiver. The naked ghost of a man, stripped of flesh and juices, was no more than the countless radio and TV waves that passed through everyone all the time. The transmitted personality had to be given form. There were mechanical receivers, of course, computer-like affairs with mercury memory cells, where a man's intelligence could be received and could be made to activate robot bodies. But that wasn't fun. The tourist trade was built for fun. Live bodies were needed to satisfy the customers. No one wanted to spend the price of a fishing broadcast at Altair 9 in order to find himself pursuing the quarry in some clanking tractor with photocell eyes and solenoid muscles. A body was wanted, even a rather attractive body. A body which would be firm where the tourist zone perhaps was flabby. Healthy where the tourist zone had wheezed. Having such a body, there were other sports to enjoy than fishing. Oh, the laws were strict about misuse of rented bodies. But the tourist trade was the only flourishing trade left on Altair 9. The laws remained strict, but they remained unenforced. Pulcher checked back with Charlie Dickon. I found out why Madeline got into this thing. She rented, signed a long-term lease with the tourist agency, and got a big advance on her earnings. Dickon shook his head sadly. What people will do for money, he commented. It wasn't for her. She gave it to her husband, so he could get a ticket to some place off-world. Pulcher got up, turned round and kicked his chair as hard as he could. Renting was bad enough for a man. For a woman, it was... Take it easy, Dickon suggested, grinning. So she figured she could buy a way out off the contract with the money from Swinburne. Wouldn't you do the same? Oh, I don't know, Milo. Renting's not so bad. The hell it isn't. All right, the hell it isn't. But you ought to realise, Milo, the committee man said stiffly, that if it wasn't for the tourist trade, we'd all be in trouble. Don't knock the tourist agency. They're doing a perfectly decent job. Then why won't they let me see the records? The committee man's eyes narrowed as he sat up straighter. I tried, said Pulcher. I got them to show me Madeline's lease agreement, but I had to threaten them with a court order. Why? Then I tried to find out a little more about the agency itself, incorporation papers, names of shareholders, and so on. They wouldn't give me a thing. Why? Dickon said after a second, I could ask you that too, Milo. Why did you want to know? Pulcher said seriously, I have to make a case any way I can, Charlie. They're all dead on the evidence. They're guilty. But every one of them went into the kidnapping stunt in order to stay away from renting. Maybe I can't get Judge Pegram to listen to that kind of evidence, but maybe I can. It's my only chance. If I can show that renting is a form of cruel and unusual punishment, if I can find something wrong in it, something that isn't allowed in its charter, then I have a chance. Not a good chance, but a chance. And there's got to be something wrong, Charlie, because otherwise why would they be so secretive? Dickon said heavily, you're getting in pretty deep, Milo. Ever occur to you you're going about this the wrong way? Wrong? How? What can the incorporation papers show you? You want to find out what renting's like. It seems to me the only way that makes sense is to try it yourself. Rent? Me? Pulcher was shocked. The committee man shrugged. Well, I got a lot to do, he said, and escorted Pulcher to the door. The lawyer walked sullenly away. Rent? Him? But he had to admit that it made a certain amount of sense. He made a private decision. He would do what he could to get Madeline and the others out of trouble. Completely out of trouble. But if in the course of trying the case he couldn't magic up some way of getting her out of the lease agreement, as well as getting an acquittal, he would make damn sure he didn't get the acquittal. Jail wasn't so bad. Renting for Madeline Goldtree was considerably worse. Pulcher walked into the unemployment office the next morning with an air of determination, far exceeding what he really felt. Talk about loyalty to a client? But he had spent the whole night brooding about it, and Dickon had been right. The clerk blinked at him and wheezed, Gee, you're Mr. Pulcher, aren't you? I never thought I'd see you here. Things pretty slow? Pulcher's uncertainty made him belligerent. I want to rent my body, he barked. Am I in the right place or not? Well, sure, Mr. Pulcher. I mean, you're not, if it's voluntary, but it's been so long since I had a voluntary here that it don't make much difference, you know, eh? I can handle it for you. Wait a minute. He turned away, hesitated, glanced at Pulcher and said, I better use the other phone. He was gone only a minute. He came back with a look of determined embarrassment. "Mr. Pulcher, look, I thought I'd better call Charlie Dickon. He isn't in his office. But why don't you wait until I can clear it with him?" Pulcher said grimly, "It's already cleared with him." The clerk hesitated. "But, oh, all right," he said miserably, scribbling on the pad. "Right across the street, and tell them you're a volunteer. I don't know if that will make them leave the cuffs off you, but at least it'll give them a laugh." He chuckled. Pulcher took the slip of paper and walked sternly across the street to the Tourist Rental Agency procurement office, observing without pleasure that there were bars in the windows. A husky guard at the door straightened up as he approached and said genially, "All right, sonny, this isn't going to be as bad as you think. Just give me your wrists." "Wait," said Pulcher, quickly putting his hands behind them. You won't need the handcuffs for me. I'm a volunteer." The guard said, "Don't kid with me, sonny." Then he took a closer look. "Hey, I know you. You're the lawyer. I see you at the primary dance." He scratched his ear and said doubtfully, "Maybe you are a volunteer. Go on in." But as Pulcher strutted past, he felt a heavy hand on his shoulder, and click, click, his wrists were circled in steel. He whirled furiously. "No hard feelings," boomed the guard. "It costs a lot of dough to get you ready, that's all. They don't want you changing your mind when they give you the squeeze, see?" "The squeeze?" "All right," said Pulcher, and turned away again. "The squeeze." That didn't sound so good. But a little too much pride left to ask the guard for details. Anyway, it couldn't be too bad, he was sure. Wasn't it? Well, wasn't he? After all, it wasn't the same as being executed. An hour and a half later, he wasn't so sure. They had stripped him, weighed him, fluorographed him, taken some of his blood, saliva, urine, and spinal fluid. They had thumped his chest and listened to his strangled pounding of his arteries in his arm. "All right, you pass," said a 40-ish blonde in a stained nurse's uniform. "Yucky today. Opening's all over. You can take your pick. Mining, sailing, anything you like. What'll it be?" "What?" "While you're renting. What's the matter with you? You got to be doing something while your body's being rented, you know? Of course, you can have the tank if you want to, but mostly they don't like that. You're conscious the whole time, you know." Pulcher said honestly, "I don't know what you're talking about." But then he remembered. When a person's body was rented out, there was a problem of what to do with his own mind and personality. It couldn't stay in the body. It had to go somewhere. The tank was a storage device. Only that and nothing more. The displaced mind would be held in a kind of pickling vat of transistors and cells until his own body could be returned to it. He remembered a client of his boss's while he was still clerking, who spent 8 weeks in the tank and had come out to commit a murder. "No, not the tank," he said, coughing. What else is there?" The nurse said impatiently, "Oh, golly, well, whatever you want, I guess. They've got a big call from miners operating the deep gas generators right now, if you want that. It's pretty hot, is all. They burn the coal into gas, and of course you're right in the middle of it. But I don't think you feel much, not too much. I don't know about sailing or rocketing, because you have to have some experience for that. There might be something with the taxi company, but I ought to tell you, usually the renters don't want that, because the live drivers don't like seeing the machines running cabs. Sometimes if they see a machine cab, they'll tip it over. Naturally, if there's any damage to the host machine, it's risky for you." Pulcher said faintly, I'll try mining." He went out of the room in a daze, a small bleached towel around his middle, his only garment, and hardly aware of that. His own clothes had been whisked away and checked long ago. The tourist who would shortly wear his body would pick his own clothes. The haberdashery was one of the more profitable subsidiaries of the tourist agency. He snapped out of his daze as he discovered what was meant by the squeeze. A pair of husky experts lifted him onto a slab, whisked away the towel, unlocked and tossed away the handcuffs. While one pinned him down firmly at the shoulders, the other began to turn vice-like wheels that moved moulded forms down upon him. It was like a sectional sarcophagus closing on him. Pulcher had an instant childhood recollection of some story or other. The walls closing in, the victim inexorably squeezed to death. He yelled, "Hey, hold it, what are you doing?" The man's head bore said, "Oh, don't worry, this is your first time. You got to keep still, you know, scanning's close work." "But, now shut up and relax," the man said reasonably. "If you wiggle while the tracer's scanning you, you might get your whole personality messed up. Not only that, we might damage your body. And then the agency would have a suit in its hands, you see? Tourists don't like damaged bodies. Come on, Vince, get the legs lined up so I can do the head." "But," said Pulcher again, and then with effort relaxed. It was only for 24 hours, after all. He could stand anything for 24 hours, and he'd been careful to sign up only for that long. "Go ahead," he said. "It's only for 24 hours. "What? Oh, sure, friend. Lights out now. Have a pleasant dream." And something soft but quite firm came down over his face. He heard a muffled sound of voices. There was a quick ripping feeling, as though he'd been plucked out of some sticky surrounding medium. Then it hurt. Pulcher screamed. It didn't accomplish anything. He no longer had a voice to scream with. Funny. He'd always thought of mining as something that was carried on underground. He was underwater. There wasn't any doubt of it. He could see vagrant eddies of sand moving in a current. He could see real fish, not the hydrogen zeppelins of the air. He could see bubbles arising from some source of the sand at his feet. Not at his feet. He didn't have feet. He had tracks. A great steel bug swam up in front of him and said raspingly, "All right, you there, let's go." Funny again. He didn't hear the voice with ears. He didn't have ears. And there was no stereophonic sense, but he did somehow hear. It seemed to be speaking inside his brain. Radio? Sonar? "Come on," growled the bug. Experimentally, Pulcher tried to talk. "Watch it," squeaked the thin little voice, and a tiny, many-treaded steel beetle squirmed out from under his tracks. It paused to rear back and look at him. "Dope!" it chattered scathingly. A bright flame erupted from its snout as it squirmed away. The big bug rasped, "Go, follow the burner, Mac." Pulcher thought of walking rather desperately. Yes, something was happening. He lurched and moved. "Oh, God," sighed the steel bug, hanging beside him, watching with critical attention. "This your first time?" "I figured they always give me the new ones to break in. Look, that burner, the little thing that just went down the climb, Matt, that's a burner. It's going to burn the hard rock out of the new shaft. You follow it and pull the sludge out with your buckets, Matt." Pulcher started gamely on his treads and lurchingly followed the little burner. All around him, visible through the churned, silty water, he caught glimpses of other machines working. There were big ones and little ones, some with great elephantine flexible steel trunks that sucked silt and mud away, some with wasp stingers that planted charges of explosives, some, like him, with buckets for hauling and scooping out pits. The mine, whatever sort of mine it was only a bare scratched up beginning. On the seafloor as yet. It took him an hour, a minute. He had no means of telling time, to learn the rudiments of operating his new steel body. Then it became boring. Also, it became painful. The first few scoops of sandy grime he carried out of the new pit made his buckets tingle. Ooh. The tingle became a pain. The pain an ache. The ache a blazing agony. He stopped. Something was wrong. They couldn't expect him to go on like this. "Hey, Mac, get busy, will you?" "But it hurts." "God almighty, Mac, it's supposed to hurt. How else would you be able to feel when you hit something hard? You want to break your buckets on me, Mac?" Pulcher gritted his not teeth, squared his not shoulders and went back to digging. Ultimately, the pain became, through habit, bearable. It didn't become less. It just became bearable. It was boring, except when he did strike a harder rock than his phosphor-bronze bucket could handle, and had to slither back out of the way while the burner chopped it up for him. But that was the only break in the monotony, otherwise the work was strictly routine. It gave him plenty to think about. This was not exactly a boon. I wonder, he thought, with a drowned clash of buckets, I wonder what my body's doing now. Perhaps the tenant who occupied his body was a businessman, Pilker thought. A man who'd come to Altera 9 quickly, on urgent business, to get a contract signed, make a trading deal, arrange an interstellar loan. That wouldn't be so bad. A businessman would not damage a rented property. No. At worst, a businessman might drink one or two cocktails too many, perhaps eat an indigestible lunch. All right. So, when, in surely only a few hours now, Pulcher resumed his body, the worst he could expect would be a hangover or dyspepsia. Well, whatever, an aspirin, a dash of bicarb. But maybe the tourist would not be a businessman. Pulcher flailed the course under his buckets and thought apprehensively. He might be a sportsman. Still, even that wouldn't be so bad. The tourist might walk his body up and down a few dozen mountains. Perhaps even sleep it out in the open overnight. There might be cold, possibly even pneumonia. Of course, there might be an accident. Tourists did fall off the Dismal Hills. There could be a broken leg, but that wasn't too bad. It was only a matter of a few days' rest and a little medical attention. But maybe, Pulcher thought greyly, ignoring the teeming agony of his buckets, maybe the tenant will be something worse. He'd heard queer, smutty stories about female tenants who rented male bodies. It was against the law, but he kept hearing the stories. He heard of men who wanted to experiment with drugs, with drink, with a thousand secret, sordid lusts of flesh. All of them were unpleasant. And yet, in a rented body, where the ultimate price of dissipation would be borne by someone else, who might not try one of them? For there was no physical consequence to the practitioner. If Mr. Lasser was right, perhaps there was not even a consequence in the hereafter. 24 hours had never passed so slowly. The suction hoses scobbled with the burners, the scoops quarreled with the dynamiters, all the animate submarine mining machines constantly, irritably snapped at each other. But the work was getting done. It seemed to be a lot of work to accomplish in 1 24-hour day, Pulcher thought. The pit was down 200 yards now already, unbraced. New wet-setting concrete pourers were already laying a floor. Shimmery little spider-like machines, whose limbs held chemical testing equipment, were sniffing every load of sludge that came out for richness of ore. The mine was nearly ready to start producing. After a time, Pulcher began to understand the short tempers of the machines. None of the minds in these machines were able to forget that, topside, their bodies were going about unknown errands, risking unguessed dangers. At any given moment, that concrete pourer's body might, for instance, be dying, might be acquiring a disease, might be stretched out in narcotic stupor, or might gaily be risking dismemberment in a violent sport. Naturally, tempers were touchy. There was no such thing as rest. As coffee breaks or sleep for the machines, they kept going. Pulcher, when finally he remembered that he had a purpose in coming here, it was not merely some punishment that had come blindly to him for a forgotten sin, began to try to analyse his own feelings and guess at the feelings of others. The whole thing seemed unnecessarily mean. Pulcher understood quite clearly why anyone who had had the experience of renting would never want to do it again. But why did it have to be so unpleasant? Surely at least conditions for the renter mind in a machine body could be made more bearable. The tactile sensations could be reduced from pain to some more supportable feeling without enough loss of sensation to jeopardise the desired ends. He wondered wistfully if Madeline once occupied this particular machine. Then he wondered how many of the dynamiters and diggers were female and how many male. It seemed somehow wrong that their gleaming stainless steel or phosphor bronze exteriors should give no hint of age or sex. There ought to be some lighter work for women, he thought idly. Then realised that that thought was nonsense. What difference did it make? You'd work your buckets off, and when you got back topside, you'd be rested and healthy. And then he had a quick dizzying qualm, as he now realised that that thought would be the thought in the mind of a tourist now occupying his own body. Pulcher licked his knot lips and attacked the sand with his buckets more visually than before. All right, Mac. The familiar steel bug was back beside him. Come on, back to the barn, it scolded. You think I want to have to haul you back? Time's up. Get the tracks back in the parking lot. Never was an order so gladly obeyed. But the overseer cut it rather fine. Pulcher had just reached the parking space, had not quite turned his clanking steel frame around when rip, the tearing and the pain hit him again. And he found himself struggling against the enfolded soft shroud that they called the squeeze. Relax, friend, soothed a distant voice. Abruptly, the pressure was removed from his face, and the voice came nearer. There you are. Did you have a nice dream? Pulcher kicked the rubbery material of his legs. He sat up. Ouch, he said suddenly, and rubbed his eye. The man by his head looked down at him and grinned. Some shiner. Must have been a good party. He was stripping the sections of rubbery gripping material off him as he talked. You're lucky. I've seen them come back in here with legs broken, teeth out, even bullet holes. Friend, you wouldn't believe me if I told you. Especially the girls. He handed Pulcher another bleached towel. All right, you're through here. Don't worry about the eye, friend. That's easy. 2 or 3 days old already. And another day or two, you won't even notice it. Hey, Pulcher said. What do you mean, 2 or 3 days? How long was I down there? The man glanced boredly at the green-tabbed card on Pulcher's wrist. Let's see, this is Thursday. 6 days. But I only signed up for 24 hours. Sure you did. Plus emergency overcalls, naturally. What do you think, friend? The agency is going to evict some big-spending tourist just because you want your body back in 24 hours? Can't do it. You can see that. The agency would lose a fortune that way. Unceremoniously, Pulcher was hauled to his feet and escorted to the door. If one of these jokers would read the fine print, the man was saying mournfully to his helper as Pulcher left. Oh, well, if they had any brains, they wouldn't rent in the first place. Then, what would you and me do for jobs? The closing door swallowed their laughter. 6 days! Pulcher raced to the medical checkout, clothes redemption, payoff at the cashier's window. Hurry, please, he kept saying. Catch you, hurry, please. He couldn't wait to get to the phone. But he had a pretty good idea already what that phone call would tell him. 5 extra days. No longer it seemed so long down there. While up in the city, time had passed along. He found a phone at last and quickly dialed the private number of Judge Pegram's office. The judge wouldn't be there, but that was the way Milo wanted it. Pulcher wanted it. He got Pegram's secretary. Miss Kish, this is Milo Pulcher. Her voice was cold. So, there you are. Where have you been? The judge was furious. He despaired of explaining it to her. He could hardly explain it to himself. I'll tell you later, Miss Kish. Please, where does the kidnap case stand now? Why, the hearing is yesterday. Since we couldn't locate you, the judge had to appoint another attorney. Naturally. After all, Mr. Pulcher, an attorney is supposed to be in court when his clients are... I know that, Miss Kish. What happened? It was open and shut. They all pleaded non-vault. It was over in 20 minutes. It was the only thing to do with the evidence, you see. They'll be sentenced this afternoon, about around 3 o'clock, I'd say, if you're interested. It was snowing again. Blue this time. Pulcher played the cab driver and ran up the steps of the courthouse. As he reached the door, he caught sight of 3 airfish solemnly swimming around the corner of the building toward him. Even in his hurry, he paused to glance at them. It was past 3, but the judge had not yet entered the courtroom. There were no spectators, but the 6 defendants were already in their seats, the bailiff lounging next to them. Counsel's table was occupied by, Pulcher squinted, by Donnelly. Oh, yeah. Pulcher knew the other lawyer slightly. He was a youngster with a good political connections that explained the court's appointing him for the fee when Pulcher didn't show up, but without much to recommend him otherwise. Madeline Galtry looked up as Pulcher approached, then looked away. One of the boys caught sight of him, scowled, whispered to the others. Their collective expressions were enough to sear his spirits. Pulcher sat at the table beside Donnelly. Hello, mind if I join you? Donnelly twisted his head. Oh, hello, Charlie. Sure I didn't expect to see you here. He laughed. Say, that eye's pretty bad, I guess. He stopped. Something happened in Donnelly's face. The young baby-fat cheeks became harder, older, more worried-looking. Donnelly clamped his lips shut. Pulcher was puzzled. What's the matter? Are you wondering where I was? Donnelly said stiffly. Well, you can't blame me for that. I couldn't help it, Donnelly. I was renting. I was trying to gather evidence, not that that's much help now. I found one thing out, though. Even a lawyer can goof in reading a contract. Do you know the tourist agency has the right to retain a body for up to 45 days, regardless of the original agreement? It's in their contract. I was lucky, I guess. They only kept me 5. Donnelly's face did not relax. That's interesting, he said noncommittally. The man's attitude was most peculiar. Pulcher could understand being needled by Donnelly, could even understand his coldness if it had been from someone else, but it wasn't like Donnelly to take mere negligence so seriously. But before he could try to pin down exactly what was wrong, the other lawyer stood up. On your feet, Pulcher said in stage whisper. Here comes the judge. Pulcher jumped up. He could feel Judge Pegram's eyes rake over him. They scratched like diamond-tipped drills. In an ordinary, political, reasonably corrupt community, Judge Pegram was the one man who took his job seriously and expected the same from those around him. Mr. Pulcher, he purred. We're honoured to have you here with us. Pulcher began an explanation, but the judge waved it away. Mr. Pulcher, you know that an attorney is an officer of the court, and as such is expected to know his duties and to fulfil them. Well, Your Honour, I thought I was fulfilling them. I'll discuss it with you another time, Mr. Pulcher, the judge said. Right now we have a rather disagreeable task to go through. Bailiff! let's get it started. It was all over in 10 minutes. Donnie made a couple of routine motions, but there was no question about what would happen. It happened. Each of the defendants drew a 10-year sentence. The judge pronounced it distastefully, adjourned the court, and left. He did not look at Milo Pulcher. Pulcher tried for a moment to catch Madeline's eye. Then he succeeded. Shaken, he turned away, bumping into Donnelly. "I don't understand," he mumbled. "What don't you understand? Well, don't you think that was a pretty stiff sentence?" Donnelly shrugged. He wasn't very interested. Pulcher scanned the mask-like young face. There was no sympathy there. It was funny, in a way. This was a face of flint. The plight of six young people, doomed to spend a decade each in each of their lives in prison, did not move him at all. Pulcher said dispiritedly, "I think I'll go see Charlie Dickon." "Do that," said Donnelly curtly, and turned away. But Pulcher couldn't find Charlie Dickon. He wasn't at his office, wasn't at the club. "Nope," said the garrulous retired police lieutenant, who was the club president, and who used the club headquarters as a checker salon. "I haven't seen Charlie in a couple of days. But at the dinner tonight, though, you'll see him there." It wasn't a question whether Pulcher would be at the dinner or not. Pop Craig knew he would. After all, Charlie had passed the word out. Everyone would be there. Pulcher went back to his apartment. It was the first time he had surveyed his body since reclaiming it. The bathroom mirror told him he had a gorgeous shiner indeed. Also, certain twinges made him strip and examine his back. It looked, he thought gloomily, staring over his shoulder into the mirror, as if whoever had rented his body had a perfectly marvellous time. He made a mental note to get a complete check-up someday soon, just in case. Then he showered, shaved, talcumed round the black eye without much success, and dressed. He sat down, poured himself a drink, and promptly forgot it was there. He was thinking. Something was trying to reach the surface of his mind, something perfectly obvious, which he all the same couldn't quite put his finger on. He found himself drowsily thinking of airfish. Damn, he thought grouchily, his body's late and hadn't even troubled to give him a decent night's sleep. But he didn't want to sleep, not now. It was still only early evening. He supposed the Chester A. Arthur Day dinner was still a must, but there were hours yet before that. He got up, poured the untasted drink into the sink, and set out. There was one thing he would try. There was one thing he could try to help Madeline. It probably wouldn't work, but nothing else would either, so that was no reason for not trying it. The mayor's mansion was ablaze with light. Something was going on. Pulcher trudged up the long, circling driveway in slush that kept spattering his ankles. He tapped gingerly on the door. The butler took his name dutifully, and isolated Pulcher in a contagion-free sitting room while he went off to see if the mayor would care to admit such a person. He came back looking incredulous. The mayor would. Mayor Swinburne was a healthy, lean man of medium height, showing only by his thinning hair that he was already in his middle 40s. Pulcher said, "Mr. Mayor, I guess you know who I am. I represent the 6 kids who were accused of kidnapping your son." "Not accused, Mr. Pulcher. Convicted. And I didn't know you still represented them." "I see you know the score. All right, maybe in a legal sense I don't represent them anymore, but I'd like to make some representations on their behalf to you tonight, entirely unofficially." Pulcher gave the mayor a crisply worded brief outline of what had happened in his case, how he had rented, what he had found as a renter, why he had missed the hearing. "You see, sir, the tourist agency doesn't give its renters even ordinary courtesy. They're just bodies, nothing else. I can't blame the kids. Now that I've rented myself, I have to say I wouldn't blame anyone who did anything to avoid it." The mayor said, "Mr. Pulcher, I don't have to remind you that what's left of our economy depends heavily on the tourist agency for income, and that some of our finest citizens are amongst its shareholders, including yourself, Mr. Mayor, right?" Pulcher nodded. "But the management may not be reflecting your wishes." "I'll go further. I think, sir, that every contract the tourist agency holds with a renter ought to be voided as a public policy. Renting out your body for a purpose which may well be in violation of law, which, going by experience, nine times out of ten, does involve a violation of law, is the same thing as contracting to perform any other illegal act. The contract simply cannot be enforced. The common law gives us a great many precedents on this point, and please, Mr. Pulcher, I'm not a judge. If you feel so strongly, why not take it to court? Pulcher sat back in his chair, deflated. There isn't time, he admitted, and anyway, it's too late for that to help the six persons I'm interested in. They've all been driven into more illegal act in order to escape renting. I'm only trying to explain it to you, sir, because you're the only hope. You can pardon them. The mayor's face turned beet red. Executive clemency? From me? For them? They didn't hurt you, boy. No, they did not, the mayor agreed, and I'm sure that Mrs. Galtry, at least, would not willingly have done so. But can you say the same of the others? Could she have prevented it? He stood up. I'm sorry, Mr. Pulcher, the answer is no. Now, you must excuse me. Pulcher hesitated, then accepted the dismissal. There wasn't anything else to do. He walked down the hill towards the entrance, hardly noticing that the guests were beginning to arrive. Apparently, the mayor was offering cocktails to a select few. He recognised some of the faces. Lou Yoder, the county tax assessor, for one. Probably the mayor was having some of the white-collared politicians in for drinks before making the obligatory appearance at Dickens' fundraising dinner. Pulcher looked up long enough to nod greyly at Yoder and walked on. Charlie Dickon? What the devil are you doing here like that? Pulcher jerked upright. Dickon? Here? He looked round. But Dickon was not in sight. Only Yoder was coming down the path towards him. Oddly, Yoder was looking straight at him. And it had been Yoder's voice. Yoder's face froze. The expression on Yoder's face was an odd one, but not unfamiliar to Milo Pulcher. He had seen it once before that day. It was the identical expression he had seen in the face of that young punk who'd replaced him in court, Donnelly. Yoder said awkwardly, "Oh, Milo, it's you. Hello, I thought you were Charlie Dickon." Pulcher felt the hairs at the back of his neck tingle. Something very odd here. Very odd. "It's a perfectly natural mistake," he said. "I'm 6 feet tall and Charlie's 5'3". "I'm 31 years old, he's 50. I'm dark and he's almost bald. I don't know how anyone ever tells us apart, anyway." "What the devil are you talking about?" Yoder blustered. Pulcher looked at him thoughtfully for a second. "You're lucky," he admitted. "I'm not sure I know, but I hope to find out." Some things never change. Across the entrance to the new Metropolitan Cafe and Men's Grill, a long scarlet banner carried the words, "Vote the Straight Tickets!" Big poster portraits of the mayor and committee man Dickon flanked the door itself. A squat little sound truck parked outside the door blared ancient marches, the sort that political conventions had suffered for more than two centuries back on Earth. It was an absolutely conventional political fundraising dinner. It would have been the absolutely conventional embalmed roast beef. It would have been the one conventionally free watery Manhattan at each place, the conventionally boring after-dinner speeches except for one. Milo Pulcher, stamping about in the slush outside the entrance, looked up at the constellations visible from Altair 9 and wondered if those same stars were looking down on just such another 1,000 dinners all over the galaxy. Politics went on, wherever you were. The constellation would be different, of course. The squirrel and nut were all local stars and would have no shape from any other system. But he caught sight of the tall, thin figure he was waiting for and stepped out into the stream of small-time political workers, ignoring their greetings. "Judge, I'm glad you came." Judge Pegram said frostily, "I give my word, Milo, but you've got a lot to answer to me for if this is a false alarm. I don't ordinarily attend partisan political affairs." "It isn't an ordinary affair, Judge." Pulcher conducted him into the room and sat up at the table he had prepared. Once it had held place cards for four election board workers from the warehouse district, who now buzzed from table to table angrily. Pulcher had filched their cards. The judge was grumbling. "It doesn't comport well with the bench to attend this sort of thing, Milo. I don't like it." "I know, Judge. You're an honest man. That's why I wanted you here." Pulcher had left before the could develop into a question. He had fended off enough questions since the thoughtful half-hour he'd spent pacing back and forth in front of the mayor's mansion. He didn't want to fend off any more. As he skirted the tables, heading for the private room where he had left his special guests, Charlie Dickon caught his arm. "Hey, Milo, I see you've got the judge out. Good boy. He's just what we needed to make this dinner complete." "You've no idea how complete," said Pulcher pleasantly, and walked away. He didn't look back. There was another fine potential question source, and the committeeman's would be even more difficult to answer than the judge's. Besides, he wanted to see Madeline. The girl and her five accomplices were where he had left them. This private bar where they were sitting was never used for affairs like this. You couldn't see the floor from here. Still, you could hear well enough, and that was more important. The boys were showing nervousness in their separate ways. Although they had been convicted hardly more than a day, had been sentenced only a few hours, they'd fallen quickly into the convict habit. Being out on bail so abruptly was a surprise. They hadn't expected it. It made them nervous. Young Fultus was jittering about, muttering to himself. The Hopgood boy was slumped despondently in the corner, blowing smoke rings. Jimmy Lasser was making a castle out of sugar cubes. Only Madeline was relaxed. As Pulcher came in, she looked up calmly. "Is everything all right?" He crossed his fingers and nodded. "Don't worry," she said. Pulcher blinked. "Don't worry." It should have been he who was saying that to her, not the other way round. It came to him there was only one possible reason for her calm confidence. She trusted him. But he couldn't stay. The ballroom was full now, and irritable banquet waiters were crashing plates down in front of the loyal party workers. He had a couple of last-minute things to attend to. He carefully avoided the eyes of Judge Pegram, militantly alone at the table by the speaker's dais, and walked quickly across the room to Jimmy Lasser's father. He said without preamble, "Do you want to help your son?" Tim Lasser snarled, "You cheap shyster! You wouldn't even show up for the trial. Where do you get the nerve to ask me a question like that?" "Shut up. I ask you something." Lasser hesitated, then read something in Pulcher's eyes. "Oh, well, of course I do," he grumbled. "Then tell me something. It won't sound important, but it is. How many rifles did you sell in the past year?" Lasser looked puzzled, but he said, "Not many, maybe half a dozen. Business is lousy all over, you know, since the high school works closed." "And in a normal year?" "Oh, 300 or 400. It's a big tourist item. You see, they need cold-shot rifles for hunting the fish. A regular bullet sets them on fire, touches off the hydrogen. I'm the only sporting goods merchant in town who carries them, and say, what does that have to do with Jimmy?" Pulcher took a deep breath. "Stick around, and you'll find out. Meanwhile, think about what you just told me. If rifles are a tourist item, why did closing the icicle works hurt your sales?" He left, but not quickly enough. Charlie Dickens scuttled over and clutched his arm, his face furious. "Hey, man, what the hell? I just heard from Sam Apfel, the bondsman, that you got the whole bunch out of jail again on bail. How come?" "They're my clients, Charlie." "Don't give me that. How did you get them out when they're convicted anyway?" "I'm going to appeal the case," Pulcher said gently. "You don't have a leg to stand on. Why would Pegram grant bail anyway?" Pulcher pointed to Judge Pegram's solitary table. "Ask him," he invited, and broke away. He was burning a great many bridges behind him, he knew. It was an exhilarating feeling, chancy but tingly. He decided he liked it. There was just one job to do. As soon as he was clear of the scowling committee man, he walked by a circular route to the dais. Dickon was walking back to his table, turned away from the dais. Pulcher's chance would never be better. "Hello, Pop," he said. Pop Craig looked up over his glasses. "Oh, Milo. I've been going over the list. I think I got everybody. Charlie wanted me to introduce all the block captains and anyone else important. You know anyone important that ain't on this list?" "That's what I want to tell you, Pop." Charlie said for you to give me a few minutes. I want to say a few words." Craig said agitatedly, "Oh, Milo, if you make a speech, they're all going to want to make speeches. What do you want to make a speech for? You're no candidate." Pulcher winked mysteriously. "What about next year?" he asked, with a lying inference. "Oh! Oh-ho!" Pop Craig nodded and returned to his list, mumbling, "Well, in that case, I guess I can fit you in after the block captain, or maybe the man from the sheriff's office." But Pulcher wasn't listening. Pulcher was already on his way back to the little private bar. Man had conquered all of space within nearly 50 light-years of dull, yellow, old Sol. But out in that main ballroom, political hacks were talking of long-dead presidents of almost forgotten countries centuries in the past. Pulcher was content to listen, to allow the sounds to vibrate his eardrums, at least for the words made little sense to him, if indeed there was any content of sense to a political speech in the first place. But they were soothing. Also, they kept his six fledglings from bothering him with questions. Madeline sat quietly by his shoulder, quite relaxed still, and smelling faintly, pleasantly of some floral aroma. It was, all in all, a pleasant place to be, as Pulcher could remember in his recent past. Too bad he'd have to go out of it soon. Very soon. The featured guest had droned through his platitudes. The visiting celebrities had said their few words each. Pop Craig's voluminous old voice took over again. "And now I want to introduce some of the fine party workers from our local districts. There's Keith Ciccarelli from the Hillside area. Keith, stand up, take a bow." Dutiful applause. "And here's Mary Beth Whitehurst, head of the Women's Club from Riverview." Dutiful applause. And a whistle. Sure, the whistle was sardonic. Mary Beth was fat and would never again be 50. There were more names. Pulcher felt it coming the moment before Pop Craig reached his own name. Then he was on his way to the dais, even before Craig droned out, "That fine young attorney and loyal party man, the kind of young party our fellow needs, Milo Pulcher!" Dutiful applause again. This was habit, Pulcher felt the whispering question that fluttered around the room. He didn't give the question a chance to grow. He glanced once at the 500 loyal party faces staring up at them, began to speak. "Mr. President, Mr. Mayor, Justice Pegram, honoured guests, ladies and gentlemen." That was protocol. He paused. "What I have to say to you tonight is in the way of a compliment. It's a surprise for an old friend sitting right here. That old friend is Charlie Dickon." He threw the name at them. It was a special political sort of delivery, the tone of voice that commanded, "Clap now." They clapped. It was important because it made it difficult for Charlie to think of an excuse to interrupt him. And as soon as Charlie realised he ought to, which would be shortly. "Way out here, on the bleak frontier of interstellar space, we live isolated lives, ladies and gentlemen." There were whispers. He could hear them. The words were more or less right, but he didn't have the right political accent. The audience knew that something was wrong. A true politician would have said, "This fine growing frontier in the midst of interstellar space is greatest constellations." He couldn't help it. He would have to rely on velocity now to get him through. "How isolated, we sometimes need to reflect. We have trade relations through the icicle works, now closed. We have tourists in both directions through the tourist agency. We have the ultrawave messages, also through the tourist industry. And that's about all." That's a very thin link, ladies and gentlemen. Very thin. And I'm here to tell you tonight that it would be even thinner if it went for my old friend here. Yes, committeeman Charlie Dickon! He punched the name again and got the applause, but was puzzled and died away early. The fact of the matter, ladies and gentlemen, is that just about every tourist that's come to Altair 9 this past year is the personal responsibility of Charlie Dickon. Who have these tourists been? They haven't been businessmen. There's no business. They haven't been hunters. Ask Phil Lasser over there. He hasn't sold enough fishing equipment to put in your eye. Ask yourselves, for that matter, how many of you have seen airfish right over the city? Do you know why? Because they aren't being hunted anymore. There aren't any tourists to hunt them. The time had come to give it to them straight. The fact of the matter, ladies and gentlemen, is that the tourists we've had haven't been tourists at all. They've been natives from right here in Altair 9. Some of them are right in this room. I know that because I rented myself for a few days. And do you know who took my body? Why, Charlie did. Charlie himself. He's watching Lou Yoder out of the corner of his eye. The assessor's face turned grey, seemed to shrink. Pulcher enjoyed the sight of it, though. After all, he had a certain debt to Lou Yoder. It was Yoder's slip of the tongue that had finally started thinking on the right track. He went on hastily. "And what it all adds up to, ladies and gentlemen, is that Charlie Dickon and a handful of his friends in high places, most of them right here in this room, have cut off communication between Altair 9 and the rest of the galaxy." That did it. There were yells, and the loudest came from Charlie Dickon. "Throw him out! Arrest him! Craig! Get the sergeant at arms! I say, I don't have to sit here and listen to this maniac!" "And I say you do!" boomed the old courtroom voice of Judge Pegram. The judge stood up. "Go on, Pulcher," he ordered. "I came here tonight to hear what you have to say. It may be wrong, it may be right, but I propose to hear all of it before I make up my mind." Pulcher cut right in before Dickon could find a new point of attack. There wasn't much left to say anyway. The story is simple, ladies and gentlemen. The Icicle Works was the most profitable corporation in the galaxy. We all know that. Probably everyone in this room had a couple of shares to stock. Dickon had plenty, but he wanted more, and he didn't want to pay for them. So, he used his connection with the tourist agency to cut off communication between Nine and the rest of the galaxy. He spread the word that Ultramycin was worthless now because some fictitious character had invented a cheap new substitute. He closed down the Icicle Works, and, for the last 12 months, he's been picking up stock for a penny on the dollar, while the rest of us starve, and the rest of the galaxy needs stays right here on Altair 9. And he stopped. But not because he'd run out of words, but because no one could hear them any longer. The noises the crowd was making was no longer puzzled. They were ferocious. It figured. Apart from Dickon's immediate gang of manipulators, there was hardly a man in the room who hadn't taken serious loss in the past year. It was time for the police to come rushing in, as per the phone call Judge Pegram had made, protestingly when Pulcher ordered them to dinner. They did so, just in time. They weren't needed to arrest Dickon so much, but they were indispensable to keep him from being lynched. Hours later, escorting Madeline home, Milo was still bubbling over. I was worried about the mayor. I couldn't make up my mind whether he was in it with Charlie or not. I was glad he wasn't, because he said he owed me a favour, and I told him how he could pay it. Executive clemency, the six of you will be free in the morning. Madeline said sleepily, I'm free enough now. And the tourist agency won't be able to enforce those contracts anymore. I talked it over with Judge Pegram. He wouldn't give me an official statement, but he said, Madeline, you're not listening. She yawned. It's been an exhausting day, Milo. Anyway, you can tell me about that later. We've plenty of time to talk. Years and years, he promised. Years and... They stopped talking. The mechanical cab driver, sneaking round through the back streets to avoid the resentment of displaced live drivers, glanced over its condenser cells at them and chuckled, making tiny sparks in the night.